widespread frost overnight. And Wednesday, sunny, highs in the low to mid-60s.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Tug of war, Oregon is caught in a high-stakes showdown over the White House's desire to deploy the National Guard. Oregon's Secretary of State tells us public streets are not a war zone, and bringing in troops trained for combat threatens to create a dangerous situation where there was not one before.
And rest assured, and rest room assured, we'll take a closer look at a story that may be causing some concern in England, despite an extremely comforting headline that reads, quote, "Sugar made from sewage not going into food chain," unquote.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Monday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. The KXE KBXE Book Club is reading How to Solve Your Own Murder by Kristen Perrin for October. Meetings are at 5:30, Wednesday, October 8th at KAXE in Grand Rapids, and Tuesday, October 21st at KBXE in Bemidji. Brainerd Community Theater presents Dracula, a Comedy of Terrors, October 23rd through November 1st at the Chalberg Theater on the campus of Central Lakes College in Brainerd. Find more information at clcperformingarts.com. I'm going to play a song for you. This is Nicole Atkins with the song Mind Eraser.
If the first thought says my mind's erased, I never want to leave again. When you spend time in a lion's cage, you never go to sleep again. These dreams, I know too well, am I sleeping? It's hard to tell. There is nothing like it. There is nothing like it. Till you do it all again. My mind's erased, I never want,
And that's Nicole Atkins with Mind Eraser.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
forcing the issue, Oregon's Secretary of State tells us no one of any political stripe there wants the president to send in the National Guard. So the state is doing everything it can to prevent that.
Breaking news or broken news? We'll hear how people inside the CBS newsroom are reacting to the announcement that a firebrand media critic known for criticizing outlets like theirs will now be their boss.
The whole truth, that is what the late forensic scientist Edward T. Blake was dedicated to finding. His work on DNA testing changed criminal trials and helped exonerate wrongfully convicted people.
Stand and deliver. A rural newspaper editor tells us about the small army of volunteers who are making sure readers still have access to local news during the Canada Post strike.
The center of attention, Connor McDavid, signs a contract extension with the Edmonton Oilers, and whatever that contract contains, a lot of money for starters, superfan Magoo, and a bunch of other people too, maybe a few, can barely contain themselves.
And can't spell candy without can. A new trial project will see toilet paper from sewage transformed into glucose, but the utility swears that that sugar won't be used in any food product.
Convinced? Yeah.
As It Happens, the Monday edition, radio that gives new meaning to ensuite bathroom. Last week, U.S. President Donald Trump told hundreds of American military leaders that cities run by Democrats were, quote, very unsafe places, and we're going to straighten them out one by one, unquote. Well, obviously, the people who run those cities don't agree, and neither do some judges. And in Oregon, the Trump administration's fight to deploy National Guard troops is playing out on the ground and in federal court. Last night, Judge Karen Immergut blocked the administration from sending out-of-state troops into Oregon. Now the White House is asking the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to step in. Tobias Reed is the Secretary of State of Oregon. We reached him in Eugene.
Secretary of State Reed, what is the situation on the ground right now? A lot is going on behind the scenes, but are National Guard troops deployed right now in Oregon?
I don't know the answer to that because things are moving so quickly with the federal judge saying that this is not a legal move. There are not troops that are visible in those in that space. Things are peaceful. People are. I mean, my favorite visual is a young man there who's in a chicken suit and with a representation of an American flag as a cape. He's been there for a long time and making his point peacefully. Over the weekend, there was a person there in a frog suit. These are grandmothers. There are people to the extent there are people there. They are peaceful and a lot of the time there are very few people there. What this move does, frankly, is to make things less safe by amping things up. It is not only illegal and unlawful, it's ineffective.
The fact that there is so much uncertainty about if, when, where these troops may be, that is telling and no doubt weighing on you and your colleagues. If
yes.
We go to the ruling itself from the federal justice, this is someone who was appointed by President Trump during his first term. What is your view, as you've looked at things, of how she interpreted the legal and constitutional questions around these deployments or the suggestion of these deployments?
Well, I am not a lawyer, but it seems clear to me that she was saying the conditions under which the president is allowed to federalize the National Guard have not been met. And the fact that the president and the administration went to such efforts to effectively go around her ruling by attempting to move to a deployment of the California National Guard to Oregon prompted her to extend her order. To be even more clear, I think is also telling. It is not needed, it is not wanted, and it's not justified.
It is being challenged by the White House, as you well know. So do you expect
Yes.
her ruling to hold up?
What I can say with confidence is that Oregon will continue to make its case in court that we believe in upholding the rights of Oregonians and the Constitution, the Constitution which, by the way, the president swore an oath to uphold. And we will make that case in court just as we have to date.
What are, if you've had a chance to speak with Oregonians, what are they telling you about just the idea that this could happen?
I think they are saying this is going to have the counter effect of what people profess to want. It is going to make things less safe. It is going to make things less calm. The idea of having soldiers, military, who are trained to be on battlefields patrolling American streets is alarming, and it should be, I think, to people no matter how their politics line up. That's a role for police. Our streets are not war zones, and I think that's the level of concern that people have. Again, people were running a marathon this weekend. They were having a good time. It was a beautiful fall day. People are concerned with the idea that soldiers are going to be patrolling the streets. I think that may also be part of the president's agenda here to normalize that. But that too is alarming, and that's what I hear from Oregonians.
As you know, the U.S. president says, quote, paid insurrectionists are threatening ICE buildings in Portland in some of the rationale for the deployments he wants to see. You and other politicians in Oregon clearly disagree with that. You've described some of what you've seen in terms of protests, and you're saying they're calm and peaceful. Where is he getting this idea that there are threats? Some have suggested in the Wire reporting, Associated Press saying that some local officials believe that he's looking at old images.
I think that is putting it charitable. The judge also, as you pointed out, said in her ruling, I'm paraphrasing now, but roughly that, you know, these political stunts are not tethered to reality. And it's true. The president is not here. He is not attached to the truth. There is no truth to these claims. You can watch local coverage of your journalistic colleagues in Portland, and most of the time there's a handful, if any, people in this location. And to the extent there have been more intensity of late, it's because, I believe, of the amped up presence of these agents. It's not an issue most of the time.
Illinois leaders there are also going to court to stop the same sort of thing in their state. Is there strength in that kind of solidarity or similar cases for you?
I think so. I think many of us are making the same arguments. You know, the same Constitution applies to all of the United States. There are conditions that are required for the federal government to take control of state National Guards. And we've now had two states, California and Oregon, where that has been judged to not be the case. I think it's likely that you know, same argument will be made in Illinois. And it just gets further, it's further evidence that this is not about facts on the ground. It's not about individual circumstances. American streets are not war zones. This doesn't matter whether you support the president's political agenda or not. There is a role for the military, and it is not law enforcement.
Secretary of State Reid, I appreciate your time. Thank you for this.
Thank you.
Tobias Reid is the Secretary of State of Oregon. He's in Eugene. There can't be many experiences more hopeless than sitting in prison convicted for a crime you did not commit. But forensic scientist Edward T. Blake gave people in that situation hope. In 1986, Mr. Blake pioneered the use of PCR testing on crime scene DNA, a revolutionary method that sparked an innocence movement to exonerate the wrongfully convicted, including Canadian David Milgaard, who was wrongly convicted of rape and murder and spent 23 years in prison. Here is Edward T. Blake speaking on As It Happens in July 1997, after Mr. Milgaard was exonerated and a new suspect was revealed.
This is the first time that a situation has happened where in a post-conviction investigation that the convicted person has been exonerated and simultaneously an alternative suspect has been included.
And fairly conclusively.
The evidence is extraordinarily powerful, yes.
Over his career, Mr. Blake helped overturn more than 50 wrongful convictions, and when the technique was adopted more widely, many more were freed. Edward T. Blake died in early August at the age of 80. His death was not widely reported until recently. Peter Neufeld is a co-founder of the Innocence Project and a longtime friend of Mr. Blake. We reached him in New York City.
Peter, I wonder what kind of reaction you've seen and heard since Edward T. Blake's passing from people who were exonerated because of his work.
Oh, they're all very, very sad. I just spoke to an exoneree in Los Angeles and who didn't know it, and he intends to come up to the memorial, which will be in Northern California, and obviously he credits his freedom to the work of Dr. Blake.
And how did you meet Dr. Blake?
Well, the first time I actually met him was at the very first international conference on DNA at the FBI headquarters. And Ed Blake was chastising me for talking to the director of the FBI about not being completely, not completing all of my statements about what was wrong with the original laboratory's work before somebody was, was tested and they reached a different result. Ed Blake thought I should always be completely truthful and not hold anything back at all.
Yeah. He didn't love lawyers. He's pretty clear about that.
Well, he didn't. He didn't, because he felt that lawyers always had some other end game and always had some other agenda. But he was great because to him, the two most important things were truth and justice. Mm. And if lawyers fell short on either end of those, he went after them.
Being chastised by someone and being told that they don't like people in your line of work or knowing about that about them might not be the best basis for a long-term connection or friendship, but it turned out to be for both of you. Did you realize in those moments that you were speaking with or being chastised or criticized by, you know, someone who was going to change the world, really?
I didn't realize the full extent of it then because it was only 1988. Mm-hmm. And in 1986, Dr. Blake became the first scientist to actually introduce DNA evidence in a criminal case anywhere.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't until the 90s that matters exploded. And throughout North America, Canada and the United States, DNA became widespread, not only used by prosecutors, but used by the defense to exonerate the wrongly convicted.
He talked as well about his worries around witness testimony and how heavily it was relied upon before his work came into play. And he talked about it in an episode of a documentary TV show called Forensic Files. We'll listen to a little bit of that together.
There are many, many limitations on the testimony of eyewitnesses, particularly in situations that where there's a great deal of not only physical trauma, but emotional trauma. That's not a place for people to make careful, critical observations.
And on top of the concerns around witness testimony, lab testing was problematic in some ways as well.
I was going to say that was one of the unusual things about Dr. Blake. Some forensic scientists would simply do the test you wanted and give you the answer. But Dr. Blake always took it one step further. He would do a critique of the original work done in the case by others and explain why it fell short. And he would put it in writing in his report. And when he testified in trial, he would go after those people and explain what they did wrong. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was negligence, but other times it was actual intentional misconduct. And he wanted those people held accountable. And if lawyers couldn't bring that if lawyers couldn't make that happen, he would be very disappointed with us.
Yeah. The specific kind of DNA testing that he brought in changed the game incredibly for a few reasons. Take our listeners through what those changes meant for considering evidence that wasn't considered before.
Right. Before they had the DNA evidence, they just used conventional serology. There were two main problems with it. One, you needed a huge, healthy sample, so you couldn't do it in most crime scene cases. Two, even if it got you a result, it wasn't very discriminating. It might say that your client and the evidence shared the same type, but so did 20% of the population. So DNA changed all that in both ways. Number one, it could handle very old, degraded, minute samples. And two, it could say the frequency of this profile is 1 in 1 million or 1 in 1 billion. So if somebody was included, it was very probative evidence of guilt. On the other hand, if you were excluded, that was the end of it.
Yeah. Are in all of the cases that he was involved in, his work was connected to, is there a case or a few cases? Certainly there's been some in Canada, several in Canada, but are there ones that stand out to you?
Well, I mean, certainly the cases he did in Canada were extraordinary because if you start with the Guy Paul Morin case, mm-hmm. which was in Ontario in the 1990s, I mean, the original conviction was in the 80s. Guy Paul was convicted of murdering a 9-year-old girl. But the DNA in the 90s not only exonerated him, but suggested who actually committed the crime. So that's what DNA does. And as a result of that case, there was a provincial commission in Ontario to investigate what went wrong in the Guy Paul Morin case and make recommendations for the future. One of the problems in the Guy Paul Morin case is that they relied on the testimony of a jailhouse snitch. And the provincial commission really went after that kind of testimony, not just in Ontario, but all over Canada, and has ushered in reforms in dealing with jailhouse informants.
You were able to speak with him earlier this summer, not too long before he died. What did he tell you?
Well, it was interesting. We talked about, I guess, a week or two before he died. And all he really wanted to talk about was problem cases that I had now. And maybe that I could change the way I was thinking about them. In other words, his mind was just as sharp until the day he died as it was, you know, 40 years ago when we first began working together. He was that kind of extraordinary human being.
Peter, I appreciate this. Thank you.
No problem.
Peter Neufeld is a co-founder of the Innocence Project and a longtime friend of the late Edward T. Blake. We reached him in New York City. Today on social media, Prime Minister Mark Carney posted, "Crisis averted." He wasn't referring to tariffs or international diplomacy. He was referring to hockey. He was responding to another social media post, this one by superstar Connor McDavid. It read, "Our journey here continues," followed by an orange heart and a blue heart, the colors of the Edmonton Oilers, with whom Mr. McDavid has signed a 2-year, $25 million U.S. extension. It's the news of Blair Gladue, better known as Superfan Magoo, has been waiting for. We reached him, obviously, in Edmonton, Alberta.
Superfan Magoo, I think I know the answer to this question, but how are you doing today?
I'm on cloud nine. I'm on cloud nine, not only myself. I'm on cloud nine with the rest of the Edmonton Oilers fans all over the world.
Was there ever a real worry or real doubt that this would happen?
You know, it's business. And hockey is, a lot of it is business. So, yeah, there was a little bit of worry, a little bit of stress, and a little bit of doubt. But as a true Edmonton Oilers fan, we knew that the captain loved it here, that he wants to win a cup here, and this is his home.
On the business side of things, I'm glad you brought that up, because Sportsnet and others are pointing out that McDavid's deal is a lot lower than Kirill Kaprizov's. That's an 8-year, $136 million contract with Minnesota, as I'm sure you're well aware.
Yep.
Are you surprised by the dollar amount that they landed on for McDavid?
You know what? The reason why I'm not surprised about this is because it's not about the money. It's about winning the Stanley Cup. And that's exactly what he wants to do. He wants to win the Stanley Cup. So we left money on the table for our Edmonton Oilers team to go out there and get either a goalie, a D-man, a power forward, or all three. It's all up to them.
What did you do when you found out today?
As soon as Sportsnet called me, I jumped in the air and I was screaming in my kitchen, enjoying my breakfast, having my Tibby's tea, and I was like, whoa, let's go! And I had tears of joy.
Really?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was an amazing feeling, like, to finally hear that. And I knew it was going to happen 2 days. Well, I didn't know 2 days before the actual season was going to start, but
right.
No, he didn't want to keep that on everybody's shoulders either as well.
So a two-year extension, as you know, does that worry you in terms of the long term?
No, it does not worry me at all. The reason being is because the salary cap is going up next year, so it is a smart thing that he did that. Because next year, when the salary cap goes up after we win the Stanley Cup this year, knock on wood, and then he can sign for whatever he wants.
You weren't the only one thinking about this, maybe even worried about this. Prime Minister Mark Carney has had a few things to say on the matter. Let's listen to that.
We are in a crisis. We are in a crisis. The global trading system has been upended. Supply chains have been destroyed. McDavid is unsigned. This is not a transition. This is a rupture. As in times like these, you have to draw back in. Remember what you have. Dreisaitl, Hyman, Nugent Hopkins. We got to draw on those strengths. We got to draw on those values. And Connor, if there's anything that we can do in the upcoming budget, we're spending less, we're going to invest more, so we can bring that cup back to Canada.
Superfan Magoo, do you think that had any bearing on the negotiations?
I think that had a little something to do with it. You know, as one of our true leaders out there, Mark Carney, to say that, man, that's a man of his words right there, and he's a true hockey fan. He knows who the best player is in the world, and him too was stressing out, as well as the rest of the fans.
Fans of other teams and those worried about those other crises he was listing might feel differently, but I totally hear you, Superfan Magoo. You talked about, you know, winning the Stanley Cup, as we always talk about with you. It's been so close, losing to Florida twice now. The money that you mentioned that will go towards helping this team win, I mean, I know you're always going to say for sure this is the year, but what feels different this time, at this stage at least?
What feels different at this stage right now is you could see it in the players' eyes. And for these players that are on the Edmonton Oilers team that lost back-to-back finals for the Stanley Cup are going to go in there playing 10 times harder, stronger, and have more willingness to do whatever it takes to get it done.
The season starts tomorrow, as you know, Calgary versus Edmonton on Wednesday. Game day is always a big deal for you, dressing up, prepping, getting in the mindset, as the players are as well. Are you going to be doing anything differently this year?
Yes. What I am doing this differently this year is I have a different beaded Oilers hat.
Oh.
That is specially, it's Indigenous culture, okay? I got it specially smudged and prayed for by the elders. And I'll be wearing that for this season.
Maybe it'll make the difference, Superfan Magoo.
And I hope that makes a difference because, you know what? Everybody has their superstitions and their beliefs, and you got to believe. And that's the thing. Always believe. Our captain's side, baby! Let's go!
Superfan Magoo, thank you as always.
Woo! Love you!
Superfan Magoo in Edmonton, Alberta. Sugar, Sugar by the Archies, in which the singer says that we are his candy, girl, meaning that metaphorically he considers us to be sweet. Or we are his candy girl, no comma, meaning that we are the girl who brings him candy, or that we ourselves are literally made of candy. When he says we've got him wanting us, therefore, does he mean he wants to spend time with us in a romantic context, or literally to consume us like a Werther's original? Well, most scholars believe that the Archies do not mean we are sugar to be eaten. And before you ask, a new product of the Blackburn Sewage Works in England also will not be sugar to be eaten. It's right there in the BBC headline, quote, "Sugar made from sewage not going into food chain," unquote. Well, we didn't think that sewage sugar would be going into the food chain until they told us it wouldn't. But the first line of the article reads, "A water company is extracting sugar from toilet paper flushed down the loo." Still, maybe the science will calm our suspicions. In this trial, United Utilities will be removing flushed toilet paper from sewage. They'll clean it, they'll wring it out, they will add some chemicals and enzymes to it. Don't ask what chemicals and enzymes, that's the Colonel's secret recipe. Then they'll heat it. The result will be cellulose, which will become glucose, which is a sugar, which has all kinds of industrial uses, but is not going into the food chain. Okay, we can stop the science music. This process has all kinds of benefits in terms of sustainability, but they insist it has no benefits or detriments for our candy because this is not mouth glucose. They swear that's the truth. They are not going to sugarcoat it. Here's the Guess Who with No Sugar Tonight. No Sugar Tonight, New Mother Nature.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, CBS names a former opinion columnist as a guardian of objective news. We'll hear how journalists there are taking that news.
And Canada Post employees are on strike, but a team of volunteers in a small Quebec town are making sure the local paper still gets into readers' hands. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Coxall.
It is 6:35, and you're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program, here on member-supported radio, KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, DJ the DJ. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. Support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8 p.m., offering guests martinis and menu items such as chicken Kiev, a Reuben, or fettuccine Alfredo. The dinner menu and additional information are available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Armory Arts and Events Center in Park Rapids has an open mic night Thursday, October 16th from 7 to 9. And there's a waffle brunch fundraiser for a new dog park in Deer River Sunday, October 19th from 9 to 1 at the Deer River Vets Club. Tickets available at the door or in advance at the Chocolate Dog. Now back to As It Happens.
It's the network of Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow. Its European operation helped combat Nazi propaganda during the Second World War. Its pioneering news magazine program, 60 Minutes, is consistently ranked among the greatest television shows of all time. And now its newsroom reports to Barry Weiss. Ms. Weiss is a former op-ed editor at the New York Times who left the paper acrimoniously in 2020, citing bullying and a, quote, illiberal environment. She went on to found the independent media company The Free Press, which Reuters has described as, quote, proudly pro-Israel, and which bills itself as an honest, independent, and fearless alternative to mainstream media. Now, Paramount, which owns CBS, has acquired The Free Press for $150 million U.S., and Barry Weiss has been named editor-in-chief of CBS News. Jeremy Barr is a media and power reporter for The Guardian U.S., and we reached him in Washington, D.C.
Jeremy, I know you've been speaking with people at CBS News. How would you describe the kind of reaction you're seeing and hearing at this point?
You know, I think a lot of people were expecting this. There's been so much reporting about this happening. I think people kind of had been preparing their emotions. So when it was finally announced this morning, I mean, I think there's certainly some skepticism. There's some concern. There's some frustration. There's also a lot of questions about what this actually means. I talked to several people who said they're in wait-and-see mode, where they don't want to sort of prejudge it. And prejudge what she will be doing and what role she might have on their day-to-day lives. It's a very, you know, unusual appointment, someone who is not experienced in television being put in this new role. And so I think employees are confused, concerned, and I think some are open-minded, but, you know, want to hear more about what's actually going to happen.
Some of our listeners may be familiar with Barry Weiss's work, but if you could just briefly, for our listeners who aren't aware of Weiss and her work, tell them a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, she's somebody who kind of came to national awareness because of her resignation from the New York Times in 2020. She stepped down from the opinion pages and said that it was an illiberal environment and that people were basically bullying her. And her kind of farewell email went viral. And she sort of emerged as a kind of pretty major critic of the mainstream media, legacy media. And from there, I think the following year, she started a newsletter called Common Sense that turned into The Free Press. Mm-hmm. And The Free Press, I think in terms of the overall media landscape, it's not a major operation. You know, it's successful on Substack, which is the platform it's published on. But it's not part of the daily national conversation per se, but they've had certain pieces that have really touched a nerve, including pieces about CBS News. There was a big piece about NPR and claims to bias at NPR. So it's kind of most known, I think, for media criticism to some degree. Mm-hmm. But I think it's, you know, it's a mix of news and commentary, and it's overall not a massive business, and it's being absorbed into, you know, Paramount Skydance, which is a huge, huge business. So it's actually a very small piece of the overall business pie, but I think it's symbolically certainly a big deal.
Apart from her own personal opinions and what she and the Free Press have focused on, there is, as you've said, the matter of her inexperience, specifically in broadcasting. Can you give our listeners a sense of how her resume compares to that of some of her predecessors at CBS News?
Well, this is a new position, as far as I understand it. Editor-in-chief is not really a position in network news, in U.S. television networks. There's a woman at NBC News whose title is VP of Editorial. And she had come from New York Times, and so I think she provides a sort of like traditional journalistic overview of the NBC News newsroom. But this is a new role, and you know they've said that she you know, will shape editorial priorities, champion core values across platforms, and lead innovation in how the organization reports and delivers the news. So shaping editorial priorities seems like the biggest thing she's going to do. But there's also a CBS News president, Tom Sabrowski, and he's going to be staying there. Mm-hmm. So the interplay between the two of them, I think, is going to be very interesting to watch. But I think employees are very curious to see what kind of shaping she'll do. I mean, I think in my personal experience, journalists do not generally like outsiders. You know, I worked at places where people came out from the outside and there was a lot of skepticism. So she has that doubly in that she's someone who doesn't have TV experience and also someone who comes from more of a commentary opinion background that seems to be taking more of a news role. But CBS News is very siloed. 60 Minutes historically has always been kind of really split off from the rest of the network. Mm-hmm. It used to be literally across the street, I believe. And so that's going to be very interesting to see about whether she has an impact on 60 Minutes, which is really the flagship show the network has. It's a very, very popular show still. Yeah. And so, you know, I think people at the network have been at the network for so many years. And so I think the idea of somebody who's not from this world and maybe does not necessarily, in their mind, embrace the traditional principles of impartiality that they have dedicated their lives to, they're not so sure about that.
Weiss herself spoke after the news came out about her new role at CBS. Here's what she told her regular podcast listeners.
From day one, the promise and the business proposition of the free press was simple. We would marry the quality of the old world to the freedom of the new. We would seek the truth and tell it plainly. And we would treat readers like adults capable of making their own choices. So many people told us this was no longer possible, that the premise of a media company built on trust rather than partisanship was at best a relic from the past and at worst a fantasy that never was. They said that the internet killed journalism forever and that there simply weren't enough Americans out there in search of media driven by honesty, independence, and integrity. You proved them wrong.
In addition to what she said there, the CEO of Paramount, David Ellison, said in a statement he believes the country longs for news that is, quote, balanced and fact-based, unquote. I wonder how the journalists you know at CBS News are reacting to those comments in particular.
I mean, I think that there's a natural question that I've heard from people about if you're trying to bring the news back toward the center, back toward impartiality, why are you hiring somebody that I think, you know, is not known for impartiality, is known for having a strong, contrarian, heterodox take on things. So there's a sort of a disconnect between what David Ellison has said about what he wants the news to be and this appointment. It doesn't make a lot of sense, to be honest, how those two things connect. I think what makes sense is that David Ellison wants CBS News to be more compelling. They want the digital offering to be more interesting. You know, Barry Weiss has had success in building a subscriber audience for her website. And if CBS News Digital could do something like that, no, that would be great. So that, to me, I think, and the people who cover the industry are thinking more about, they're less focused on sort of the highfalutin language about it mm-hmm. and more focused on what she actually could bring, which I think is sort of this digital media entrepreneur sense, which is probably more what CBS News needs. Because, you know, when you watch the news broadcast tomorrow night, they're not going to be different than they were tonight, right? It's not going to change that quickly. And I think that CBS News journalists all adhere to at least a belief in impartiality. And so it's not like they had not felt that way previously.
Jeremy, I'm glad we could speak. I appreciate this. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Jeremy Barr is a media and power reporter for The Guardian US. We reached him in Washington, D.C. The question of what your vote is worth usually does not refer to a monetary cost. But for some people, the cost of casting a ballot in the Newfoundland and Labrador provincial election may be too high. The Canada Post strike has made it impossible to mail in special ballots, so out-of-province voters have been told they have to pay to ship their special ballots back for next week's election day, which could cost upwards of $30. That has some people wondering whether to cast their ballots or cast their ballots aside. University student and first-time voter Maria O'Neill told the CBC what happened when she spoke to Elections NL.
I got a call from Elections NL asking if I could come and vote in person, because, of course, the strike is going to make mail-in voting much more difficult. And I explained, no, I can't. I'm not going to be in the province during the election. And they basically asked, oh, will I be coming home maybe for Thanksgiving? Is there somebody I know that might be traveling back and forth between Nova Scotia and Newfoundland who I could give my ballot to bring home? Then they explained if I want to vote by mail, they can courier it to me, but then I would be responsible for sending it back. And then I basically had to decide on the spot there on the phone what in the world I was going to do, and I looked up some prices from couriers, and they were all very, very expensive. I don't think anybody should have to pay to vote at all, and definitely not the amounts that it would cost to send through FedEx or Eurolader or something like that. The cheapest ones I saw were probably about $40 or so.
How do you feel about that, and how does that sort of make you think about your first time voting?
Really frustrated. It's such a barrier to me, and I'm really worried about how many other people it's going to affect. I'm 21 now, and I've never had a say in provincial elections or provincial politics. And yeah, I'd just like to have my opinion heard, my vote count, you know?
Maria O'Neill talking to the CBC's Laura Howells. Elections NL did not respond to requests by CBC Newfoundland and Labrador for clarification. The provincial election is on Tuesday, October 14th. The Canada Post strike is having an impact on elections elsewhere in the country too, including in Quebec, where some 1,100 communities will head to the polls in November for municipal elections. And in the lead up to that vote, the editors of one local newspaper remain committed to making sure hard copies end up in readers' hands, no matter the postal disruption. Jennifer Robinson is the co-editor of Tempo. We reached her in Brome Lake, Quebec.
Jennifer, Tempo is a monthly bilingual as well. What went into crafting the October edition, particularly considering there's an election coming up?
Well, you know, October is like every other month. We've been publishing for 43 years now. It's a totally volunteer organization, all written by volunteers. And this month has been particularly challenging because we have municipal elections in Quebec coming up on the 2nd of November. And so we've been interviewing candidates and writing about the issues, getting information out to people about how important it is to vote, where they can get for more information. So it was a crucial issue. All our issues are very important, mm-hmm. can I just say? But mm-hmm. this issue was particularly important because it's got so much practical information for people who have to make an informed choice in a month. So,
and who are your readers?
So we serve five communities. There are about 12,000 residents in these five communities. It's sort of southern Quebec, east of Montreal. One of our big industries is tourism. Louise Penny lives here. Mm-hmm. She holds all her book launches, and we have a literary festival coming up, which is really important. People love. So getting that information out to our readers is important.
You've heard the argument, of course, I'm sure, you know, when we talk about local outlets, people say, you can get this information online. Is there anywhere else your readers can get the kind of local bilingual news coverage that you're offering?
Yeah, so we have a website, and we also are very active on Facebook. Because we only publish once a month, it's important to fill that time between our paper publication with information on Facebook. But we don't make it to the news very often. So we really are the only source of information about our community, about people in our community, issues that are important to people here in this whole area. It's important for us to get the paper out.
So when you found out that the strike was indeed going to happen, what went through your mind and your co-editor's mind? What, you know, the gears that are turning, the things that have to be put into place when something like that happens?
Okay. In a word, panic. So Canada Post delivers our newspaper free of charge to 6,000 mailboxes in our area. So on the first of every month, it lands in everybody's mailbox. So what we did was, you know, I phoned up 15 of our best volunteers, and we delivered it to local businesses who were really thrilled about being able to, you know, stockpile it for people who wanted to pick it up. So the local grocery store, the town halls, the bookstore, the cafes, restaurants, all that. They all have been so wonderful in making sure that Tempo is available through them. To people who come through the doors.
So you weren't able to deliver it door to door to all of those 6,000 homes, but
yeah. We did actually in some neighborhoods. We had volunteers who were especially keen. So they did actually put it in mailboxes in some neighborhoods, but it's a pretty big territory. We don't have a lot of people. We have a lot of territory here. Yeah.
Your community is one of 1,100 municipalities heading to the polls in November. What kind of impact do you think this Canada Post strike might have on all the kinds of things that people need leading up to a vote, the access for voters to information?
Okay, so the vote that's coming up are municipal elections. We serve 5 different municipalities, and each one of those is having an election on November 2nd. And so things like mail-in ballots, a card saying that you're registered as a voter, all that is not getting to people. So yeah, it's important not only for our, you know, local democracy, because this is a very hotly contested election, at least in one of the towns. And it's important that people are able to vote and that they know how to go about doing it.
And what are people in the community, readers, for example, telling you about the impact more broadly of the strike?
Well, it's affecting everything that relies on the mail. And we have post offices in each one of these little communities that actually kind of serve as centers of the community and to a large degree. Yeah, I mean, I think everybody just wants this dispute to be resolved in a way that will make Canada Post viable, but also maintain some of these essential services that we receive now from Canada Post.
We've spoken to a lot of folks on this program who are running small news outlets or having to shut them down and how emotional it is. It is no doubt very difficult to keep publishing Tempo every month in the world we live in, even when there isn't a postal strike to deal with. So what keeps you going?
You know what? It's really commitment to community. I think that's what keeps us going. And again, you know, we're all volunteers, so we're not getting paid for this. We just love the work we do. It's a great team. We love to share information about people and issues and all the activities that are going on in the community. And I have to say that a newspaper, a community newspaper that reflects the community, is so important to the quality of life here in our area anyway. We are French and English here. So about half the population is English still. And I believe it really knits our community together in a way that it's almost impossible to any other way. So the newspaper is fully bilingual. Everything's in French and English. Everybody loves it. Everybody contributes to it. It just raises the quality of life. We find out about our neighbors. We find out about cultural activities coming up, you know, the theater, the museum, the library, all these things we're sharing information about. So yeah, very important.
Jennifer, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Neil. Thanks very much.
Jennifer Robinson is the co-editor of Tempo. We reached her in Brome Lake, Quebec. There are 30 beluga whales left at Marineland in Niagara Falls, Ontario, and where they'll go next, if anywhere, is still unclear. The park wanted to send them to an aquarium in China, but Ottawa refused to grant Marineland export permits. It has also refused to give Marineland any emergency funding, which the park says it needs to properly take care of the belugas. Now animal advocates are asking the Ontario government to step in because they fear for the lives of the belugas. Melissa Matlow is a campaign director with World Animal Protection. She talked to David Common, host of Metro Morning.
This is a privately owned park. The belugas are privately owned. Is it not just possible to work with Marineland rather than force ownership or control of the animals to another entity?
That would be ideal, but we've been trying to work with Marineland. We've been trying to get the Ontario government to bring Marineland to the table to work with experts for quite some time, and they refuse. And I think they've lost the public's trust in taking care of these animals properly.
So the feds are the ones who would be responsible for issuing an export permit. And for this one park in China, they've said, no, that's not going to happen. Why is it the province that has control over jurisdiction, I should say, over the animals themselves?
The province has jurisdiction over the welfare of captive wildlife when they're in a facility in the province. They're in charge of animal welfare, and they have authority under the Ontario Animal Welfare Services Act to seize the animals in place.
You have told us previously that perhaps 10 of these 30 belugas could possibly go to a marine park that's being set up off the shores of Nova Scotia. The fisheries minister has also come out and said that just because she said no to the park in China doesn't mean she would say no to any other or other options on where to send these whales. Are there other options outside of Nova Scotia that you know of?
We hope that by bringing experts from accredited zoos and aquariums to the table, that there could be a place where these animals could go. There are other seaside sanctuary initiatives as well underway. So ideally, they could be held for some time until they could finally go to these other sanctuaries that are being created.
What is the point at which euthanizing the animals becomes the best or only remaining option?
When an independent veterinarian and whale welfare expert says that that is the best option, we can't trust Marineland in stating that. They're clearly doing it because they're running out of funds. That's not the right reason.
That's Melissa Matlow from World Animal Protection talking to David Common on Metro Morning in Toronto.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.